Okay, welcome back, everybody. Wonderful to have everybody here. This is part three of our course, Jewish Political Thought, which we're advertising as a Gemara Shir, and every week we have one or two Gemarot mentioned, but it is certainly a Torah Shabbat Al-Peh Shiur. And after the introductory first class, we're focusing on the golden age of Jewish thought, which is the Middle Ages, and specifically for our purposes, it is really Spain. I've spent the afternoon with a very proud Sephardi guy, a big person in his community, and really sold to him that this is basically a Sephardi course. It's all taking place in Spain, which is interesting, by the way. I was speaking to some people here this morning about it. Why is this a Sephardi course as opposed to an Ashkenazi course? Right, the people that we're focusing on, the Rambam, Rabbeinu Nissim today, the Abarbanel next week, why are we not speaking about Rashi and Tosfot when it comes to politics? Anybody have any broad ideas? Dana?
Well, I know that in Spain, for example, Jews had more political power as opposed to
Right, so that's in many ways, that's true, and sometimes in a very specific sense. So for instance, the Abarbanel, who we're going to look at next week, was one of the most important political figures in Spain and Portugal of his time. He was head of the treasury, he was a major advisor to kings and queens. But it's also true on just like a broader cultural level, that the Jews of France and Germany had very, very little to do with their non-Jewish surroundings, to be certain business interactions, but in terms of culturally, there was an attempt to very much block themselves off, really because the non-Jewish surroundings were so deeply unfriendly. Jews were subject to limitless taxation, etc. By contrast, in Spain in the Middle Ages, it was a much more comfortable environment. And this also connects up to our topic somewhat. This isn't just true in general, it's specifically true about politics. Politics, more than maybe any other area within Jewish thought, is one where the sages of the Masorah, of the tradition, have been much more open to absorbing non-Jewish ideas than they would be, say, in other areas. Anybody sort of have a guess as to why that might be? Or think of sort of certain examples of it? Why, when it comes to politics, would you be more willing to absorb non-Jewish, external, foreign ideas and bring them into your canon than you might be with, say, another area?
Less interpreted, probably.
Right, in a sense, it's less loaded, yeah. Right? It's not about faith. Right, exactly. You can maybe distinguish it from theological issues. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
Well, also,
so it's Sophia, right?
Yeah.
So you're definitely correct with that, but what's interesting here is the material that we're looking at, because the Jews of the time obviously didn't have their own independent state, they're not thinking about, you know, how do we deal with this reality, this messy reality in front of us. In some ways, they're painting the ideal Jewish state, and yet nevertheless, they're still bringing in non-Jewish ideas to it. Who's the first political advisor in Tanakh? Who essentially set up? I guess so, right? I mean. Right, that's what I was thinking of, right? You make a very good point of, you know, Jewish advisors to a non-Jewish kingdom in terms of Yosef to Paro, but the really interesting one is Dana's example, that the person who essentially sets up the political apparatus of Am Yisrael in the desert is not a Jew. It's Moshe's father-in-law. It's Yitro. And already the Torah, as we've already seen in the first class, and it says very explicitly that the whole idea of kingship is Kechol Hagoyim, right? Just like all the nations. The idea of monarchy seems to come originally from a non-Jewish source altogether. So it's not by chance, by coincidence, that I'm saying this this week rather than any other week. Because the person who we're going to look at today, Rabbeinu Nissim, better known as the Ran, who lived in the 14th century, 1320 to 1380, more than any other thinker, is going to claim that there is going to be tremendous overlap between what is politically correct in the eyes of the Torah and for the Jewish people, and what is politically correct in any other society. So much so, and I'll say the most extreme version of it first, and then we'll work out over the course of the class how we get to that, so much so that it might be, says the Ran, and this is a shocking thing for such a significant halachist to say, it might be that the laws of other nations have superiority to the laws of the Torah when it comes to politics, right? I'll put that shocking line out there, and we will try to grapple with what it means over the course of it. Definitely don't stop listening at this point, otherwise that could be damaging.
Does that stem from like Derech Eretz Kamal Torah?
He doesn't ever invoke that line, but that might be connected to it. What we spoke about last week in the introduction was this fascinating dispute between two of the great sages in the 20th century in the 1930s and the 1930s, in the run-up to the declaration of the State of Israel. Rav Herzog, who was the first chief rabbi of the State of Israel after Rav Kook, and the great sage in Ashkenaz in Europe at the time, Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. And Rav Herzog had this idea that the Torah now would be able to exist on a completely different level in Medinat Yisrael. It wouldn't just be the directive for what people do in their homes, in their kitchens, or in shul. Rather, the Torah would be able to be combined with government. We would now have Jewish law, not for the individual, not for just for the community, but for the whole state, for the whole society. And he based this approach on, as we saw last week, on the Rambam who understands this tremendous fusion between the Torah, between religion on the one hand, and law and politics on the other. The king, in the view of the Rambam, isn't just some functionary who preserves political order. He is one of sort of the highest positions that the Torah envisages for achieving its aims. His role is to bring justice, to establish the true religion in the world. He is really viewed with tremendous political clout, as a religious clout, so much so that eventually when the Rambam describes what Moshiach is going to look like, it's essentially the very best possible king. It's a real, really great political leader. That was what Rav Herzog built his vision of. Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, by contrast, argued for a complete separation of religion and state. He wrote back to Rav Herzog that rather there should be two different parallel systems, one system of regular Batei Dinim, Jewish courts of law, just like it existed in the diaspora for 2,000 years, and then a completely secular courts within and government within Israel, and the two would not exist with one another. How did he get to such a position? And partly this is an argument between a religious Zionist and even if not an anti-Zionist, a Haredi non-Zionist. How did Reb Chaim Ozer get to such a position? The answer is the Ran Rabbeinu Nissim. So it's fascinating. This very important 20th century argument goes all the way back to the Middle Ages. Before we jump into the Ran, let's watch a video. This video is from 2011. Anybody remember anything that happened in London in 2011? Protests? You might be right. No, I mean maybe this yes as well. But I was leading a group of Jewish youth from across the world around London that summer, when London basically went crazy. In all seriousness, I spent about an hour on YouTube last night trying to pick my favourite video for it. A wanted criminal was being chased by the police through a housing estate in an area of London called Tottenham. He was then shot by police, which then triggered days of rioting throughout London, with youth taking to the streets, smashing shop windows, smashing police cars, breaking buses, and critically looting, stealing huge amounts of shops. They'd break into shops and people would have fled and they'd just be taking everything. Over a few days later, these then spread to the rest of the country, and it took at least half a week before the police were able to get this under control. And let's just get a little sense of it here. This is Vice News.
Bureaucracy. Monday afternoon, with shops boarded up, it was clear that all London needed to explode was a spark. And this was it. At the Narrows, at the end of Mare Street in Hackney, three police vans swerved to a stop. About 10 policemen rushed two men. A crowd quickly formed, exciting themselves and freaking out the police. Soon there were two groups and bricks were being thrown. A gridlock of cop cars and rioters grew beneath the bridge, and soon there was a running battle up Mare Street. The crowd was split into two, half of whom were chased up Morning Lane, where they broke into Tesco's. "Missile up," they shouted, while pulling out Coke cans and bottled water and charging towards the cops. The rest of the crowd were moved up Mare Street, and that's when everything started to go crazy.
So why do I showing you that video? Last week we spoke about sort of like the grand vision of politics. Like for the Rambam, politics ends up with Mashiach. But politics in the most basic sense doesn't start with what's the highest, the grandest vision. It starts with the lowest, the most basic. How is it that we are able to live together? How is it that we are able to sleep in our beds at night without being worried that we're going to be stabbed in the back and looted? And politics, at its most basic, answers those questions. So now I want to ask a really basic question. The vast majority of what took place in London in terms of the criminal stuff during those 2011 riots was looting. Huge amounts of stuff was stolen from high street stores, even pathetic stuff like cans of Coke being stolen from a Tesco's, not to mention TVs, clothes, electrics. Like, stores would just be, you know, ruined in order for people to run. According to the halacha, now transfer to the world of Baba Kama, of Makot, of Sanhedrin. According to the halacha, what should happen?
To the people that were committing the crimes?
Yeah, very, 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 I don't know if anybody was killed. Very, very few people were killed. Huge damage done.
Well, obviously all the stuff should be returned and like the damage value or whatever.
Right, so what is Eliezer? So Eliezer is quoting the halacha that what is the punishment for theft? Ve'heshivet ha-gezelah asher gazal. You return the item that you stole, and if it's stolen in a certain fashion, you pay twice. Right? That is the maximum. Tell you the truth, actually, you would only pay once in this case. Right? Because the difference between a ganav and a gazlan is whether you steal in public or whether you steal in private, and the crime for stealing in private is double that of stealing in public. If you steal in public, you only have to return the gezelah. Does that sound like a particularly heavy punishment for what took place in London?
Forget that. Who can you pin it on? You don't know what the person knows.
Let's say you catch the person, right? All the police could do, if the police were acting according to halacha, they would find whoever it was who had stolen TVs, they'd knock on their doors and say, "Sorry, do you mind returning the TV?"
But stealing wasn't the only crime.
It's the vast majority. Okay, well, damage.
They have
restitution of damage.
In Judaism,
I'm saying like civil unrest, and like inciting riots also is like a crime in
and
of itself. Like, you're not allowed to yell fire when there's no fire. It's illegal.
We're working from the Torah. I mean, what you've got is the breakdown of society, basically. And that it's so seemingly the halacha is going to be extremely hard to punish in any practical, significant sense. This is without ever getting into the question of Edim, and of Hatra'ah, of having witnesses who've warned the person understands what is being told to them, etc., right? Let's think in the most practical sense. If you are to give London or New York the halachic guidelines for establishing law and order, in response to that, it would seem that the halacha is just so, has such high standards of evidence and such low forms of punishment that it would be almost impossible to establish political order in the aftermath of that. Nobody would go to prison. Halacha doesn't have a concept of prison. Nobody would have a significant fine beyond what is given. Here's my favourite one. Even if you do have to pay double, there's a halacha called modeh b'knas patur. Anybody learn Baba Kama? What's modeh b'knas patur?
You admit to a fine and you don't need to pay it.
Right. If you say, I did something wrong and I shouldn't have done it, then the halacha, which would give you a knas, would give you a fine, such as paying twice, says actually you don't need to pay twice, you just return the basic item. Now, of course, in the art, if you're to send a message to, you know, the youth of London and Birmingham who rioted in this way, that that is just not acceptable and you're destroying people's lives by doing that, if all you're then saying is, please return what you stole, that is no way going to act as a deterrent. Now, it's not me who first realised this in 2011, although it was around 2011 that I first came across this Rashbah. The Rashbah is a generation before the Ran. He's also rabbi in Barcelona, Rav Shlomo ben Aderet, one of the greatest poskim and halachists of the Sephardi world. And here he says as follows. This is in his shut, in his responsa. He's being asked a question as whether the Bet Din is allowed to impose punishments which the Torah does not mandate, or if it's able to relax the laws of the Torah's requirements for evidence. V'ro'e ani, and I say, she'im ha'edim ne'emanim, if you've actually got trustworthy witnesses, etzel ha'borim, for the people who are checking it out, rashaim hen liknos mamon or onish haguf. The Bet Din is able to impose fines or punishments, physical or monetary punishments, beyond the scope of the halacha, even though the halacha doesn't mandate it. Hakol lefi mashi yireh lahem, all according to what they think is fitting, what is appropriate. Why? V'zeh hamakayem ha'olam, in order to keep the world going. She'im atam ma'amidin hakol al hadayanin hakatzuvim al hadinim hakatzuvim b'Torah. If you're going to establish everything on the basis of what the Torah tells you, if you're going to work with Masechet Sanhedrin, which says two scrupulously observant witnesses, etc., etc., v'shelola anosh, and to not punish people, elak moshe ansha Torah, except how the Torah punishes, b'chavelot, when it comes to physical violence, v'chayotze b'zeh, nimtza ha'olam charav, the world would be destroyed. You would not be able to establish political order because the requirements for evidence of the halacha are so high, and the punishments, relatively speaking, are so low. Shehayinu tzrichim edim v'hatra'ah, we would require two witnesses and warning in every case. V'kom, and this is fascinating Gemara, he now quotes, v'komo she'amru chazal, like the sages said, lo chalva Yerushalayim, Jerusalem was only destroyed, ele she'emidu divrehem al din Torah, that they only judged strictly according to the Torah, they didn't have any flexibility in there. V'kol she'ken b'chutz la'aretz, how much more so in the diaspora, where we don't have the same powers of a Bet Din as we used to have. Absolutely fascinating piece. The Rashba is without a doubt a league halachist, right? There is no, he is the very front row of the most important poskim and writers in the Middle Ages. Still to this day, every day in Kollel Halacha, I would use the Rashba. Is saying that when it comes to questions of politics and establishing social order, the halacha is not sufficient. We are not able to establish the order that we would want to, and so we've got to be able to go beyond it and punish even if we haven't got the requirements that halacha gives us. This is what, maybe you're not finding this counterintuitive in the way in which I did at first, but you know, you have so many people who say, oh, halacha's so strict, or you know, the Torah's so so difficult, or you know, it punishes things so harshly. The very, very opposite. Right, if you're actually a judge who's trying to establish order according to the Torah, it's almost impossible. Here's Reb Chaim Moshe Grudzinski in his letter to Reb Herzog explaining why he thinks there should be two parallel systems. According to the Ran, who we're going to get to, with regards to thefts and robbery, he did not write in English, I just put the translation, and other types of crime, the law of the monarch, of the king, was granted a special status distinct from that of the religious course. For truly, it would be most difficult for the proper functioning of a society if a thief could acquit himself through double compensation alone, and one who confessed to a deed bearing a fine were exempt entirely. Thus, in such matters, one is forced to enact special state ordinances.
Was the Rashba talking about a Beit Din going above the law, or like a separate entity like a king?
A Beit Din. The Rashba is talking in the most extremely practical sense, right? The Rashba is the head of the Beit Din in Barcelona, and he's answering a question as to whether or not a Beit Din can punish when, according to the halakha, it doesn't seem like it is able to, right?
So the law of the monarch is like the royal we.
So we're going to come to the law of the monarch, the law of the king, is going to be the very, very heart of what we're now going to get into. At this stage, we've only spoken about things in a very practical sense. How would the halakha respond to the 2011 riots? What did the Rashba think about a certain case that was given to him, which he couldn't punish according to the laws of halakha? What we're going to now see in the next generation, the generation after the Rashba, is the way in which the Ran, going from this original insight, basically works this up into a whole theory of political thought, deep within Parashat Shoftim. You remember we started with Parashat Shoftim a couple of weeks ago. Shoftim, which speaks about different political institutions, it speaks at its very start about the appointment of Shoftim v'Shotrim, judges, systems of law, but it also speaks about Minui HaMelech, the appointment of a king. And for the Ran, these are going to be two completely distinct ideas. There is the law of the Torah, which the shofet, which the judge establishes and works according to halakha. And there is the law of the king, Mishpat HaMelech, which is going to be able to do something else altogether. And when it needs to, it's going to go well beyond the guidelines that the Torah itself describes. And the Ran is not going to approach this in the way in which both the Rashba and Reb Chaim Ozer seem to describe it as, we'd love the Torah to be able to do it, but what can we do? Our hands are tied, so we've just got to do things differently. The Ran is going to work this up into a sort of a lechatchila version, an ideal vision of the Torah, which is encompassing a very fundamental truth about human society and how they should function. So let's take a few minutes. Let's do it in Havrutot. Turn to the person next to you. I started with 8,500 words last night of the 11th drasha of the Ran, source number 3. I was able to get it down to about 1,500 words in terms of the core stuff, and then translate it. So take a few minutes, start with the beginning of it, learn it with a Chavruta, and see how does he work this idea up of the difference of these two systems of law working together, the law of the Torah and the law of the king, and what different needs are they answering? What is appointed to who? What are they showing about human society? What are they showing about the nature of the law? Let's get stuck in. Source number 3. Turn to your person next to you and enjoy your Havruta. Most of it has been translated.
I can read it.
Okay, shall we come back together, everybody? All right. I let that go a bit longer than we have in the past because it seemed there's a lot to get through, and it seemed that people were enjoying studying together. Before we dive into the words, let's call this a Gemara class, and let's introduce the Hakira. Right, Hakira, classic yeshivish Ion way of studying Gemara in depth, which is to take a certain idea or a concept, a certain phenomenon, and ask what is it that lies behind it, and to present two different ways of looking at it. So let's ask the ultimate political question and present the ultimate political Hakira. And that is, politics is about a collective, it's about a community. There's no such thing as the politics of an individual living in their own world. Why do people come together? Why do we live in groups?
Scared.
From a Jewish perspective or not?
You know what? You can find the machloket is between Aristotle and Hobbes, and you can find exactly their parallels within Jewish thought as well. So either way, the question can overlap. Why do people come together?
Scared.
Scared. That's right. That's scared of the nasty, horrible world out there. Who did you mention? Right, Thomas Hobbes, living in the English Civil War, is the seen as the master of this idea, although of course it exists when people come together in order to protect themselves against the threats out there. They give up some of their personal rights and they give them to the police, to the state, whatever it is, in order that they can sleep safe in their beds, because violence is a natural, ineradicable part of human nature and of the world. That is the basis from which the run starts. The run sides with that idea, Rabbeinu Nissim, starting off by saying every single society needs some sort of politics. That's what Plato has taught us. That's the Chacham that he quotes. No, the run, as far as I know, lived a relative... I think it was persecution at the time. I don't think there was war. It's a bit ironic, really, that the Rambam, who we saw last week, is the opposite approach of this. The other side of Aristotle is that people don't come together because of mutual fear, they come together because of their mutual benefit and of the wonderful things that society is able to achieve. Man is what Aristotle called a social animal. This was really what the Rambam focused on, this idea of what we can achieve together and in the religious Jewish sense of our spiritual needs that are brought together. But it's interesting that you mentioned, as far as I know, the Ran did not live during wartime, but the Rambam had a very, very difficult life. So it's interesting that nevertheless he didn't put that idea at the heart of his politics. Yeah, Donna.
They're not necessarily exclusive though, because you can say it's an either or. So like if you all come together, then I'll be bad, and if you come together, I'll be good.
Quite right, Tzvedinim, right? Literally Tzvedinim, and that is exactly what the Run recognizes. Right? The Run understands that on the one hand, violence is a natural part of the world, but on the other hand, we are also spiritual beings. Right? And so, we require two different forms of law. What the Torah's commands in general are, what he calls mishpat amiti, true law, mishpat tzedek, true just law, that is for the purpose of our spiritual world and our spiritual well-being. He has this fascinating idea of, this seems to be Am Yisrael's particular dimension and religious idea, in order to bring down the Shefa Eloki, to bring down God's... the downpouring of God's gifts to them. Karen?
In the case where there's conflict between the law of the land and the law of the Torah, which one is the one that we're like...
Within the run? So let's keep that within the run. On the one hand, by answering Dana's question, that's what the Torah prescribes, true law. Truly just law. And according to the truly just law, you can only put a person to death if he was warned, and if he truly understood what was on the cards, and he nevertheless acted anyway. That is what the truly just law requires. Nevertheless, the Torah also recognizes that sometimes that is not going to be enough in order to establish order. As we saw with the Rashba, as we saw with Reb Chaim Ozer and the 2011 riots. And so what does the Torah do? The Torah itself creates a parallel system called Mishpat HaMelech, the law of the king, where the king is able to enact or is unable to punish, even if the din amiti, the halakha itself, doesn't allow for it. And so you've got these two parallel systems living side by side. I don't know if people got there, but this is a very powerful idea. Consider the following case in Sanhedrin. This is the bottom of the second page. Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis taught, this is what you ask a witness in a capital case. Do you know him? Did you warn him? Did he confirm your warning? Did he accept liability to death? Did he commit the murder immediately? And only if the answer is yes to all of those questions, then can you put a murderer to death. But in the absence of them, you can't punish them. So the Mishpat Amiti, which is the true law, has to have some sort of supplement, has to have some addition in order to allow for what he calls tikkun seder medini, to allow for just the society to survive, and that is the law of the king. So the two exist side by side. Now, does anybody remember from last week, did the Rambam allow for anything like this? The Rambam, yeah, Pinchas is...
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the words.
Now, the Rambam did recognize that there could be certain cases where, where people need to be punished, even though the halakha doesn't allow it. And he allowed the king only in capital cases to that, in cases of murder. But for the most part, the Rambam did not see this tension there, right? He did not, he understood that the king was there to really be the representative of the religion. Yeah, Pinchas.
Didn't he also allow in cases of Morid Malchut?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't that be any?
No, but that wasn't to for the Rambam. That was the halacha that Morid Malchut was punishable by death, regardless.
So it's not only what are you saying?
Sorry, Catholic, where somebody would be put to death, okay. Then one is able to have it. But the Ran understands this as actually a much, much deeper conflict. And so he sets up these two different systems, one in order to judge truly, as it were, the answer to our spiritual requirements, and one in order to judge according to the needs of the hour. What are people's responses to this? Does this sound like a defeat? Does it sound like an admission that the Torah is unable to cope with the running of society? Jackie?
The way that I saw it, I don't know if this is really the way that I read it, is that the I'm thinking about it as a Venn diagram where the objective of the Torah is for people to, the Jewish people to bring God into the world, right? So that's like Torah's mission. And then there's also the mission of keeping a civil society, but that's not the Torah's objective. So it's nice that like some laws overlap, like don't murder, but since the goal is not to maintain a civil society, there needs to be other laws to supplement that. But it's not a deficiency in the Torah, it's just the Torah has a different goal, so obviously it wouldn't be encompassing everything in society.
Now, the Rambam could never accept what you're saying, and nor could Rav Herzog, because both of them think that the Torah is absolutely concerned with everything of society and seeks to bring God into all of those elements, and so it would never recognize that conflict. What you're saying, which I think I agree is something that the Ran is certainly there, and somebody like Rav Chaim Ozer was also there, says that the fundamental insight of the Torah and of Judaism is what it means for our spiritual needs and for true justice. And when it comes to politics and a civil society, then that's delegated somewhere else. That is given somewhere else. Brandon, were you adding something? Now, does that sound... Yeah, Aaron.
It just seems... I would say rather than a deficiency in the Torah, it seems like it's mostly just like a deficiency in the community that's being governed under. So it's like, ideally... You would be able to go through this kind of line of questioning and then be able to punish appropriately. But if people aren't, if people aren't up to the highest standard for this kind of procedure, then essentially it's like you can't have this level of judging because like the standard of the ethos of the people aren't on that same level to be judged in the first place. So you need to make up by that by having like another auxiliary set of laws that kind of match where the community is to make up for that. Because you're not up here. When the Torah's up here, you're right here.
Right.
So you have to
go
down.
So I think in part it does have an admission that the halakha can't cope with the demands of establishing political order in society. But at the same time, it's the Torah itself which legislates both systems. Right? Mishpat HaMelech, the king's law, is itself given by the Torah. The Torah is really sort of... the Torah's got this internal division where it says for the spiritual needs and for true justice, we have the halakha, we have Mishpat Tzedek V'Amiti, true just law. When it comes to politics, when the Torah itself legislates this separate one. The Rashba didn't seem to imply that. The Rashba earlier seemed to say, well, what can you do? You've just got to act beyond what the halakha allows. The Ran builds that up into the theory of the Torah itself. So when I said that astonishing line at the start, where that, according to the Ran, sometimes perhaps certain Gentile, non-Jewish forms of politics might actually be better in terms of their goal, labriut, of achieving political order, that is now no longer so surprising. Let's just read that particular paragraph. Where was it? This is on page 3. Right? Here he's talking about what is unique to the Torah is that the Torah addresses our spiritual needs through law in the way in which no other code does. That's why we have Shoftim, and we require Shoftim more than any other nation. But we require a king just in the way in which any association of people, any group requires a king. And this is the bit I made bold in that third Hebrew paragraph on page 3. Umipneze, and because of that, efshar shimtza b'ktzat mishpateu v'dinei ha'umot, you might find in certain laws of other nations, mashehu yotel karov l'tikun hasidur ha'medini, a better, more refined version of achieving political order, mimashi yimtza b'ktzat mishpatei ha'Torah, from what you'll find in the Torah on that subject. Ve'ein anu chasrim b'zeh davar, but this doesn't count as any deficiency or any loss whatsoever. Ki kol ma sheyechzar mehatikun hanizkar, because anything which is lost in that way, hayu mashlimo hamelech, the king would be able to make up for. So what the king does can change completely with the times and can absorb and can get the best new ways of political governance and association. The real uniqueness of the Torah is not what the king does. Any thoughts at this point, at this stage? Yeah, Dorit.
I mean, it sounds really nice that basically what it sounds like to me is that he creates a system of checks and balances,
mm-hmm.
and then the reason why we're having this conversation is because it's not explicit. So, like, in terms of his time of the hour quote that he
right.
keeps saying, is that in each, you know, generation or in each community, it depends on the framework of the place that you're in,
mm-hmm.
But it's still, like, divinely imported or whatever, but what's, I guess, like, speaking modernity or other times, like, that's where we sort of had this confusion, but also, like, how do you decide who is appointed? How do you decide who you subscribe to? And that, like, if it really is, you know, a divine creation or like some piece of that, how can you define for yourself what is an enhancement or in line with...
Well, maybe let me ask a sort of a leading question in this regard. Think about the Ran and the Rambam from last week. Who would be the more easier to adapt to democracy? Both are speaking about kings. Both aren't speaking about democracy. Sorry?
The Ramban.
Ramban?
I mean, the Ran, sorry, the Ran.
Why, go on. How?
It's much more secular. It's division. It's secularistic. It's
what the Ran is interested in is what's the best for politics. So, you know, in previous eras, it was about kings. And if democracy now fills that role, then that's fine. The Ran doesn't see anything particularly important in the king. But the king is just doing a job that needs to be done. By contrast, for the Rambam, the king, the Melech, was one of the greatest and most significant features of all of Judaism. So much so that eventually it ends in Moshiach.
But that's also because that expectation is set that the king is not just like the political order, but has like a divine purpose. Whereas
absolutely.
Here the king is like just the guy that's...
Or maybe we could even push, just invert what you're saying to make the point, which is that political order for the Rambam is also of great religious significance. So this is now going to have so many nafkaminot, it's going to have so many practical differences, right? For instance, what happens when Israel were exiled from their land? According to the Rambam in Mori Nevuchim, prophecy came to an end. You can't have prophecy in the absence of having your own land, because your land is where you're able to achieve the true goal of the Torah. But what happened according to the Ran when we lost political independence, when we were exiled? We just lost the political element, which is something that was shared with all other nations. But we kept the absolute core of our religion, which is Mishpat Din Amiti, the spiritual. Therefore, that the Rambam ends up being much more attractive to somebody like Rav Herzog, a religious Zionist, and Rabbeinu Nissim, the Ran, is a much more comparable thinker for a Haredi rabbi like Rav Chaim Moshe. But what's the difference in terms of how the king is viewed? So where the Rambam viewed the king so positively, the Ran is actually much more hesitant, much more sceptical about how to look at the king. And we'll finish with this. Remember why the Rambam, this idea, we come back to it, that the king had to have two Sifrei Torah, right? So for the Rambam, the king had two Sifrei Torah because it captures his importance. So everywhere he goes, there's a Sefer Torah because he represents the religion. But for the Ran, he has to have his own separate Torah because his position is so much more given to one of arrogance. It's so one which is so much more has a potential for libogas, for his own ego. Bottom of page 4. This is the difference between a judge and a king. The magistrate is more bound to the Torah's law than is the king, right? The judge can't veer from the halacha. That is why the king was admonished and commanded to keep a copy of the Torah by his side. Since the king sees that he is not bound to Torah law as the judges, he must be strongly admonished not to deviate from the commandments, yamin or small, to left or right, in view of the great power that God has given him. God has given him power to go beyond the Torah, right? So that gives its own danger. The judge, however, requires no such admonition. His power is restricted by the scope of Torah law alone. Over the page, we're staying for the English. Because he's endowed with great power, he's not subjected to the laws of the Torah the way a shofet, the way a judge is. Therefore, if he's not imbued with perfect reverence for Hashem, he's likely to overreach beyond that which is command for the welfare of the people. Because he's not subject to the Torah, the potential for his own arrogance becomes much greater. Accordingly, he's commanded to have a Torah scroll with him at all times. Dorit used the idea of checks and balances. That's very, very fitting here, right? The Torah is the check on him. And just to skip to the bottom of that paragraph, because I think that captures it so much. When he then does go beyond what the halacha prescribes in order to achieve political stability, the bit that I made in bold at the top of that page in the Hebrew, lo tihye kavanato laharot memshalto. When he punishes somebody not in accordance with halacha, but in the way in which he's allowed to, his intention shouldn't be to show that his power, la'am, to the people, shehu shalit al zeh, that he's the master of who lives and who dies. Rather, yikaven ba'asotozeh, his intention with it should be, kadesh mitzvah tiltzach, lo tiltzach, that the mitzvah, the commandment of you shall not murder, titkayem yoter, v'lo yifrutzu aleh, and shouldn't spread. In other words, even when he's acting in a non-halachic manner, as he's prescribed to, it's not on account of his own strength, but rather to uphold the values of the Torah, of lo tiltzach, which the halacha itself is not able to at that point. And here, just to... if we're to connect it to current politics and the elections and just the nature of politics, I found this final paragraph very, very powerful in terms of how one should look at a politician, how one should look at a leader. If the Rambam sort of viewed the king as this great and glorious personality, at least in the ideal sense, look at how the Ran views it. Quotes the Gemara in Harayot. Always nice to have a Gemara in the Gemara Shir. Do you imagine I'm offering you rulership? Do you think, says Hashem to David, to a king, that I'm giving you rulership? Rather, I'm offering you abdut, I'm giving the king servitude. They spoke to him, quotes the Pasuk in Malachim, they spoke to David saying, if you will be a servant to the people this day, to be a king means to be an eved, means to be a servant. Regarding David's statement, lift up your head so the king of glory, Hashem, may come in. Hashem is the king of glory. Rabbeinu Yonah Mijirona wrote as follows, that no king rules gloriously, rather the glory rules them instead. Take that line. No king rules gloriously, the glory rules them. If the masses wish to glorify a king, then he'll rule. Yet should they stop to wish to strip him of his glory, then he'll forfeit his sovereignty entirely. Thus kings do not rule over glory, it rules over them. Hashem is the king of glory, he is the true king, he rules over it and controls it. What the Ran has given us is a view which is much more sceptical about human power. The king fulfills a need, but no more than that. Certainly he doesn't edge into being Moshiach. He is able to make up for, to supplement what the halakha cannot do for tikkun seder medini, for political control. What the halakha aims at is the true, spiritual, just law. That is what it maintains. What you've got here is a fascinating political theory, which rather than bringing religion and politics together in the way in which the Rambam did, each one complementing the other, actually serves to separate them. Yashar koach, everybody. Next week.